What about the famous example of St. Monica and St. Augustine? What do you know about that?
Well, what everyone knows, everyone knows anything about them. St. Monica had to pray for him. It was a mother of a wayward son. Augustine was a brilliant boy and a brilliant young man and was making a brilliant worldly career, but he wasn't anywhere near the faith. It was breaking his pious mother's heart. But his mother had to pray for many years before Augustine at last converted. And she once went to the great St. Ambrose in despair and said, Bishop Ambrose, my son is a long, long way away from the faith. What can you do about it? And the bishop said, Mother, the child of so many tears will not be lost.
So in other words, it takes a little bit of perseverance, too. We shouldn't give up if they don't come around after the first discussion.
Absolutely, and mothers for their children need to suffer. Conversions, souls are expensive, and our Lord of course paid the great part of the bill on the cross, but he wants us also to pay our little part, and so a mother needs sometimes to shed tears of blood in order to obtain the conversion of her children. But a mother's prayers are very powerful.
What about doing penances? Because I've heard some spiritual fathers say that if prayers don't work, maybe God is telling us to try a little harder, so to do a few penances for an intention.
Without doubt, penance helps, and penance gives puts some force and strength behind prayer. Because, as the old saying is, sticks and stones will break my bones, words will never hurt me. If prayers are merely words, well, then a few sticks and stones and of penance will hurt God in the sense of obtaining from him what we want to obtain from him. Penance can definitely help, yes.
Now, I'd like to look at the political situation. We've talked about, let's say, apostasy and faith on an individual basis. The new constitution of the European Union does not mention God. This has created considerable controversy. Is formerly Christian Europe now under the domination of unbelievers and secularists?
Surely. Europe is in a very bad way. Europe is hugely godless. I can remember when I was at the seminary in the United States, the seminarians used to go to Europe once, the senior seminarians, the upper seminarians, seminarians in upper years, used to go to Europe once every 3 years to do a tour of these great sites of the faith in Europe. And they would come back. I never went with them, but they would come back. And they were shocked, these young Americans who have no culture, have no history, etc., etc., all the things that America's always accused of. They were shocked when they saw the contrast between these great monuments of history and the faith in Europe and the present-day inhabitants of Europe. And they would say, these young Europeans are second-class Americans. I mean, we are first-class Americans, but they are now imitating us, and they do a bad imitation. That's one of the things that they used to say. In other words, Europe is in a bad way. It's very, very godless, and it's going to be punished.
Is that what usually happens to peoples that abandon God?
Absolutely. God chastises those whom he loves. If God did not chastise peoples and nations that fall away from him, he would have stopped loving them, and that's not likely.
Now, did that happen in the Old Testament to a people that he loved, the Israelites of the ancient world?
It happened continually. We read there, every time the Israelites were good boys, the Lord God rewarded them with prosperity and victory over their enemies, but every time they were bad boys, they were conquered by their enemies and they were stripped of their prosperity and so on. Down to and including, of course, the time when they betrayed and killed our Lord Jesus Christ himself. And ever since, the Jews have been punished with wandering all over the world, persecuted and despised. And it's not necessary a solution that it's a punishment of the Gentiles that the Jews are now back in Israel. It's not necessarily a reward for the Jews that they're in Israel, because it's doing them not much good. It seems to be not doing them spiritually not much good. They say this is a reward of God, that we are back in Israel and so on, but it's not yet clear that it's a reward, because they are as godless as ever, apparently. Maybe something is moving inside, the Spirit of God is moving inside in secret ways that we know not of amongst the Jews in Palestine, but in any case, they've been wandering the world for 2,000, nearly 2,000 years, and that's been a severe punishment for a very, very severe crime.
And you think the same could be happening, or will happen to the Christian peoples that abandon their faith?
I was saying, Our Lady in Akita in Japan in 1973 said there's going to be a deluge of fire, a worldwide deluge of fire. I think we're in a situation that is like, only comparable to the situation before Noah. Mankind is sinning universally and more, and it has to be punished. The only alternative is that God would have lost his power, that God would not know what was going on, that God would be unable to do about what was going on, or that God would not care about what was going on. If he didn't care, he would have ceased loving us. He can't cease loving us, therefore he's going to care. He has the power, he has the knowledge, he's going to punish.
Now, from about 18th century onwards, the churches had to fight, like kind of a rising tide of skepticism or unbelief. That was the focus of a lot of papal encyclicals prior to Vatican II. Yet today, there seems to be a revival of some non-Christian religions, like Islam or even paganism. Do you see that happening?
When Europe was Catholic, the Mohammedans were rendered more or less incapable of invading Europe or troubling Europe. But now that Europe is no longer Catholic and Europe is losing the faith and falling away from the faith, the Mohammedans are flooding back into Germany, into England, into France, and they threaten to take over the Western countries because they at least have children. The dying away of Catholicism, the loss of faith, leaves a great gap, both in an individual and in a society and in a civilization. And that vacuum needs to be filled somehow. And men fill it with liberalism, or they fill it with communism, both of which are substitute religions, or they fill it with materialism, or they fill it with Mohammedanism, but they have to fill it with something. So, of course, a variety of false religions come back when the true religion begins to drop.
Is there even today a revival of Satanism?
Oh, yes. Ask any policeman in any police station, I guess anywhere in the West and maybe elsewhere as well, they will tell you about the rise of Satanism. They know about these covens in the woods and the signs of witchcraft and the sacrifice of animals and then finally, of course, tragically, the sacrifice of human beings, especially children. The police can tell you about it.
So then maybe it was unbelief that we focused our discussion of for the last hour or so. Perhaps unbelief is partly a transitional phase between Christendom to the reign of Satan?
G.K. Chesterton once said, when men don't believe in God, they don't believe in nothing, they then believe in anything. So they will believe in any false religions, and at the end of the line, they will come to worshipping Satan.
And so what we're really heading towards then is the reign of the Antichrist, which would be the reign of Satan.
Definitely. The agents of the Antichrist are at work. Globalism is the agents of the Antichrist at work. And they are shooting to bring back, to bring on the Antichrist. He will come because Scripture said he will come. God will allow him as a punishment, at the supreme punishment at the end of the world. At the same time, the Catholic Church will still be there. And the Catholic Church, the greatest of all persecutions, will be generating some of the greatest of saints of all time, of all the history of the Church. So it's not as though the picture is completely black, but we are heading for very troubled times, yes.
But is it sometimes during these hard times the faith starts to revive?
Yes, God allows persecutions in order that the Catholics pull themselves together and become more fervent and more faithful.
Did that happen to a degree in the French Revolution?
Yes. Coming out of the French Revolution was the punishment of a good deal of very tepid Catholicism in the 18th century. And coming out of the French Revolution, was both a destabilized world, but also a tremendous upswing of the faith and of the missionary effort, for instance, of the French. And the French sent missionaries all over the world, that was then all over the globe, that was then being opened up. Similarly, the Irish sent a lot of missionaries. The 19th century was, in many ways, a revival of the faith. In England, you talk about the Second Spring. The First Spring was when Catholicism arrived in England in the late 500s and early 600s, coming from St. Gregory the Great. The Second Spring was the upswing of Catholicism in England in the 1830s and 1840s. And through the rest of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, there were a lot of conversions in England, so that even in Protestant, hard-headed England, so that by the time of the Council, 12% of England was once again Catholic.
Now, we've talked briefly about England. I would like to talk now a bit about the United States. The United States is a very crucial country in the world because it's the world's leading power. And you have a unique perspective on the United States in that you have lived in the United States and you've lived outside of it. What do you think are some of the key strengths and weaknesses of this great country?
The great strength, well, firstly we're talking about people, because it's the people that make the land and not the land that makes the people. The United States is a very beautiful country with all kinds of variety and all kinds of natural resources.
We're talking here about Americans then.
Yes, well, let's talk about the people of the United States. And they're good-hearted, they're generally speaking good-hearted, and that's a lot. It's by no means always a supernatural charity, but there is a certain natural goodness and generosity amongst the people. And I think, obtains a great deal of benevolence from the Lord God. And he's given them a great deal of prosperity, and he's given them, of course, a great deal of power. So the Lord God has given to America many gifts, and Americans have done much, at least on the natural level, to deserve those gifts. The weakness is surely religious liberty. That is the underlying destabilizer of the American heart, mind and heart. Because if I believe in religious liberty, then I believe that all religions are more or less good. That's the modern idea, and it's ecumenism, and it's Pope John Paul II, and it's the religious liberty now throughout the church. But it's a great weakness of the United States, a great weakness anywhere, because if I believe all religions are good, then if two religions contradict one another, like a religion which believes in the real presence, and all those religions that don't, either one is right and the other is wrong, or the other one is wrong and the other is right. They can't both be right. But if I believe they're all good religions, then I stop believing in true and false, because I say that true and false don't matter. It doesn't matter whether you believe in the real presence or not, because these religions are all good. In other words, religious ideas don't matter. And if religious ideas don't matter, then no ideas matter, because religious ideas are the most serious of ideas. If religious ideas are unimportant, then all ideas are unimportant. If all ideas are unimportant, then the mind is unimportant. And so what you've got, the great weakness of America is the mushing of the mind. And it's the great weakness also of the modern world.
And doesn't this go back right to the founding of the United States in the 1780s, this idea?
It does, because the United States was not formed by immigrants or natives of only one religion. The Spanish and the French brought Catholicism with them, but the English, of course, brought Protestantism with them. And it's the English who won out. And therefore, the basis of the United States is Protestantism and liberalism, which is precise, Protestantism first and then liberalism. And liberalism is precisely this idea that religion doesn't matter and truth doesn't matter.
And so it was the English who originally implanted these ideas, which got taken then another step further.
The most important person in American history, arguably, you can make a case that the single most important figure in American history is King Henry VIII. who of course had nothing to do with the United States, but by turning England over to the Church of England, by founding the Church of England, and by pushing out the Roman Catholic Church in England, by destroying the Catholic Church in England, Henry VIII laid the foundations for the Protestantism that would come to the United States, and that Protestantism is the essential problem of the United States.
Isn't the religious liberty kind of that was experienced in the United States a new departure for Western civilization? Because up until that time, there generally was an established religion. Like, let's say, for example, one manifestation of this idea was that in Germany, after the Protestant Reformation, the people ultimately adopted the religion of the prince. Yes. So it was a new departure in the United States. Wasn't it a new departure then to have people just following any religion they like?
Yes, it was definitely. It's definitely a new idea. It was a new age, and that's why many Americans are proud of America being the pioneer of a new world, of a new way of life and a new world. And because America was founded upon this new idea at the moment of the independence, on the contrary, in Germany, while the Peace of Westphalia of 1648 is essentially a kind of equal weighing of Catholicism and Protestantism, let each region of Germany go with whichever of the two, the prince, whichever religion the prince holds. Nevertheless, Germany wasn't founded on that idea, and that's a big difference. You scratch Germany and you come down to several centuries of Catholicism underneath, like in England. But you scratch America and you come down to Puritans and Protestants and then liberals. And it's a big, big difference.
Now, I'd like to discuss, too, the vitality of religion in the United States. Because we have talked about religion in Europe. Some commentators have said that religion is dead in Europe, whereas that doesn't seem to be the case in the United States. Do you think religion there has more vitality?
Well, I've just been accusing Protestantism of being responsible for the essential problems of the United States, and of course that's true anyway. On the other hand, I also said that Americans are good-hearted and generous in many, many cases. And that also goes back to their Protestant religion to a considerable extent. Not because it's Protestant, but because the Protestants did maintain in the United States a religiousness. A famous French commentator observed it, Alexis de Tocqueville, observed it in the 1830s, 1840s in America. And he said the strength of America, of the United States, is the grassroots religion. And that grassroots religion, even down to today, does still to some extent exist. And that's why some Americans say that America is religious where Europe isn't. A Catholic has got to qualify that. It's Protestantly religious, yes, but that's a very dangerous basis to build on. It's all very well being religious, but if you're Protestantly religious, your religion has a serious weakness, and therefore it's not a real religiousness, and that's the problem of United States of American religiousness. It's not a real religiousness.
But the traditional movement is showing a great deal of vitality in the United States.
That's true. Yes, that's true. The Americans have got energy, another of their qualities. They've got energy, they've got drive, they will do things. And if you can once get them the right ideas in their heads and get them fired up, they will go and they will do things. They won't sit on their backsides and do nothing. So at the moment, yes, if I was the devil, the traditional movement in the United States would be worrying me. And if I was the devil, I would be seeking for a way to infiltrate it and undermine it in the United States.
On the other hand, suppose what is going on in the traditional movement in the United States could somehow be replicated throughout the whole country, then that would be a great triumph for the church.
Yes, if the traditionalists in the United States could convert their fellow Americans by their, could make the generosity and good-heartedness of their fellow Americans see that their ideas matter, that they, especially the Catholic ideas are true, and that they should live by those Catholic ideas. If that happened, that would be the conversion of the United States, which would be an example for the world, if that could happen. As I say, if I was the devil, I would be worried about what's going on now, and I would do my best to put an end to it.
Now, there is a school of thought, though, that says that the Catholic Church is actually better off if it's not the established religion, and another school of thought that says that it's even better if it's persecuted.
It's not... Well, you've got to distinguish between per se and per accidens, or... in other words, by accident, a fire... For instance, a fire burns down a house. Part of the house was rotten, and it's best that it was burned. Okay, so the fire did some good, but it's only by accident it did some good, because only by accident was the house partly rotten. The rest of the house that got burned... Normally, burning down houses is not a good thing. Similarly, essentially... The best situation for the saving of souls is when all of society is Catholic and when the state and the church are working hand in hand. That is the best situation. For instance, when the policeman and the priest are working hand in hand. The priest, even in a little town, the priest can deal with situations that the policeman can't deal with. The policeman can deal with situations the priest can't deal with. Naturally, they work together and they can do a great deal for one another. Similarly, the state and the church on the national level. They naturally, they're natured to work together, and they can do a great deal of good for one another. It's only accidental if the church is better off being separated from the state. It's not natural. Similarly, it's not normally better off for the church to be persecuted. It's only accidental if the persecution produces saints and martyrs. Normally, the largest number of souls will be saved if the church and state are working hand in hand.
So it's best if society is organized so as to facilitate the salvation of souls?
Definitely.
Like in medieval Europe?
Definitely. Then you've got the largest chance for the largest number of souls to be saved. When the institutions of the state, instead of promoting pornography and protecting pornography, are condemning pornography. Many ordinary souls have got a better chance of saving their souls.
So the fact that, let's say, God is sometimes using the evil to draw a greater good doesn't mean that it's a good thing that that evil is there.
Exactly. God allows for evil to exist because he will draw good out of it. But that doesn't mean that the evil is good.
Now, interestingly enough, we have talked about the United States and its policy of kind of religious indifferentism. Is that the right way to put it?
Yes. Indifferentism means that it's indifferent, or it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't matter what religion you belong to. And that's a very, very widespread idea. Just so long as I'm a good guy and I mow my front lawn and I play a decent game of golf, it doesn't matter what religion I have. That's a very dangerous idea.
But that seems to be prevalent in today's world. Now, interestingly enough, the same error of indifferentism in the United States seems to be the same error that today's churchmen have fallen into.
Yeah.
There's a very good parallel there.
What you've got is a Christian world order being taken by, being replaced by a new world order. The American Revolution, the French Revolution, the American Revolution were both great steps in the direction of the new world order. And the world, the revolutionary world created by the American Revolution and the French Revolution and other revolutions finally got to the church. The church resisted through the 19th century, which was quite Catholic. But halfway through the 20th century, the church finally gave way to the revolutionary idea, and so exactly the same ideas of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, fraternity, and the American Revolution, religious indifferentism, came into the church. And so the church, too, is now working, the structure of the church, the large part of the structure of the church is now working for the New World Order. It's not the real church, of course, but it is many of the churchmen working for the New World Order with the same ideas as the French Revolution and the American Revolution.
And hasn't Bishop Valley, for example, had an exchange or a debate kind of with Cardinal Casper, who's a leading proponent of this view that one religion is as good as another?
Yes, Bishop Valley says that Cardinal Casper has lost the faith. What he's teaching is absolutely not the Catholic faith. And these churchmen of Vatican II are, as Americans would say, off the wall. They've lost their heads. They can't think any longer. Their minds are mush. And that's the dreadful consequence of religious liberty, is that at the end of the line, your mind turns into mush. For everything that isn't material, you don't believe in truth. Anything goes. And that's the state. And when anything goes, then I'm capable of saying that Catholicism is true and that the opposite of Catholicism is true. Any other religion is true. I'm capable of saying outside of the Catholic Church there is no salvation, and then the next moment I'm saying outside of the Catholic Church there is salvation. I can, when my mind is mush, it accepts contradiction, and I can say anything and the opposite of anything, and I can believe them both at the same time.
Well, isn't that true, though, that perhaps if you confronted one of these cardinals or one of these upper echelon
churchmen
who believed in this new way of thinking, if you challenged them and said, do you believe all the articles of the Apostles' Creed, do you think they'd probably say yes?
Oh, absolutely. They are convinced that they still have, I believe, a large number of them, I'm not sure it's all of them, but I believe that a large number of them are firmly convinced that they still have the Catholic faith. But they are firmly convinced also that the modern world is good. And so what's needed is to hold the Catholic faith in such a way that it doesn't exclude holding also the modern beliefs. In other words, their minds are gone. And they can't think any longer. And therefore they're perfectly capable of accepting one thing and the opposite. And so I think you quoted the example of Pope John Paul II saying that outside the Catholic Church there is no salvation. I'm sure he's convinced of it. And at the same time, he's convinced that these other religions are more or less okay. That he lives in contradiction. And ever since Vatican II established contradiction, and ever since, the mass of churchmen following Vatican II have lived in contradiction.
Isn't this a new departure for the proponents of error? Because, let's say, to use the Protestant Reformation as an example, Luther was very clear. He said, the Catholic Church believes this, and I believe that, and it's different.
You're quite right. There are two stages. The first stage, after Catholicism, the first stage is Protestantism. Let's say, Catholics believe this, and Luther says, here stand I can do no other, I believe something completely different. But Luther is at least solid in his belief. The Catholics are solid in the truth. Luther is solid in error. But the next stage is, when you've got somebody solid in truth against somebody solid in error, you combine it and you say, well, then let's not be solid. Let's combine the truth and the error by not being solid. And that's the modern mind.
If the modern churchmen have this mentality, isn't there a danger then that the laity could fall into confusion?
The laity today are lost in confusion. The poor sheep are all over the place, precisely because the shepherds are wallowing in contradiction. And it's because the shepherds are wallowing in contradiction that the sheep are so confused. If the shepherds are confused, how can you expect the sheep not to be confused? And that's the situation you have today. So the laity have got good reason to be confused.
Well, I talked to one member of a parish council once who said that he finds it difficult that at one time the church was saying this, yeah, and now it's saying that.
Yeah. Well, that's just, there must be 1 million examples of that all over the world ever since Vatican II. Because the modern world is opposed to the Catholic Church. Vatican II accepted the essential ideas of the modern world, and therefore you're combining things that can't be combined. And if in your mind you insist on combining things that can't be combined, you're going to blow the fuses of your mind. And the electric circuits in your mind just don't work any longer. And so gobbledygook, truth in, gobbledygook out. You could talk truth to these Catholic churchmen, but they will talk nonsense back.
Well, it seems to me then that the world of today seems to be divided kind of into two camps. One could be described as unbelief. There was a prominent British cabinet minister who recently said something to the extent that religion is mumbo-jumbo. Then you have another group of people, which is another camp, that seems to say basically all religions have something interesting and good to say.
The two things are the same. Look at it from this point of view. The two things are the same. Because if one is just one stage on, if all religions have something good to say, and if all religions contradict one another, which they all do, otherwise they wouldn't be different religions, if they all contradict one another, they all have something good to say, then what they say doesn't matter. Then it's mumbo-jumbo. It's worthless mumbo-jumbo. If you stop and think, the religion being mumbo-jumbo follows from all religions having something good to say.
So in other words, this indifferentism and its manifestation of ecumenism could lead a lot of people simply to lose their faith.
You go from Catholicism to Protestantism to liberalism to indifferentism and atheism. Yes, definitely. Liberalism leads directly to loss of faith and atheism.
Did Archbishop Lefebvre ever write about this subject?
Essentially, yes, in several of his books, which are freely available. He was constantly on this essential theme.
And he took the stance that he did because he realized the dangers of religious liberty and indifferentism.
At Vatican II, he saw, which he took part in, from 1962 to 1965, he could see the church being destroyed under his eyes. He could see the ideas coming in, the modern ideas coming in, which would destroy the church. And he said so, but he wasn't listened to. At the end of the council, he said there was a group of about, I think he said, 400 bishops who saw the problem clearly by the end of the council. But he says a few years later, that group was broken up and dissolved. And so these bishops who, even if there were 400 bishops who saw the truth by the end of the council, they did not stick to their guns. They were either Pope Paul VI got rid of them, or they retired, or they died, or they despaired. In any case, Archbishop Lefebvre was left as the only one who stuck to his guns and said there is a truth, and this truth is the complete Catholic truth, and it can't be changed, and therefore we've got to stay with Catholic tradition.
Does the fact that it's only a small minority that is following this path, does that cast some doubt on its validity?
No. In more than once in the history of the people of God, it's the remnant that's kept the faith has been small. Remember Elias crashing down under a tree in total discouragement because he said, I'm the only one that's keeping the true faith, and the rest of the Israelites are giving themselves over to Baal, the false god Baal. And the angel told him, no, there are 7,000 that have not bowed the knee to Baal. He said, you're not the only one.
But
7,000 was still a very small number.
I'm sure that a lot of traditional Catholics have gone through something like that.
Exactly. You crash down under a tree in great discouragement and despair. But you should read. I forget which chapter. It's in the books of Kings. Probably three Kings. In a Protestant Bible, that would be 1 Kings. Either you number it 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 3 Kings, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, or you number 1, 2, 3, 4 Kings. So in any case, let's call it the third book of Kings. I think it's in the third book of Kings, about the 9th chapter, I think.
Now, is the new Mass both a manifestation and a source of indifferentism?
Yes, it is. Because it was designed by Paul VI to diminish the Catholic elements to make it more acceptable to the Protestants. And that, is the first step. That was what he had in mind, to make the Catholic Mass more acceptable to Protestants. And that was the first step in Catholicism, Protestantism, liberalism, indifferentism, atheism. So it was, that's the effect that the new masses had upon masses of Catholics, to set them on a slippery slope to losing their faith.
You know, the Society of St. Pius X has rejected this indifferentism and ecumenism. Does that represent a problem for these modern church authorities?
Yeah, of course. We are refusing to buy into their program, and we are raining on their parade, as Americans would say. And they don't like it.
Because it seems to me that these authorities sometimes are more upset about the criticism of their policies than about the Mass itself. Well, because sometimes the authorities will grant recognition to traditional groups, provided that they stop criticizing the path that the Church is on.
Yes. Well, what that means is that Catholicism has to be complete or not at all. 95% Catholicism won't do. So what these churchmen are doing, because the 5% will eat up the 95% if it's allowed to. So what these churchmen are doing is saying, well, we'll give you part of what you want, but not all of what you want. So if we insisted upon criticizing, they'll say, okay, well then we'll insist upon criticizing, but we won't give you the Mass. In other words, the churchmen are trying to keep hold of, what I was saying earlier, Vancouver. And if it wasn't Vancouver, they'd try to keep hold of Newfoundland, or whatever it was. In other words, they want us, defenders of the truth, to allow still a little bit of error, or a bit of error in our system. Because if only we will keep a bit of error in our system, the churchmen rely upon that error eating up the truth again. So we will slide down the hill. In other words, we climb back up the slippery slope, but not completely to the top onto dry land again. Just so long as we stay at the top of the slippery slope, but on the slippery slope, that doesn't matter, because then we will slide down again. That's their calculation.
Yes, well, an example of that is that there has been pressure on some traditional priests working in the system to at least attend the Charism Mass.
Yeah, there you are, the Chrism Mass, yes. That some gesture, some hostage. We have to leave behind something. And in Catholicism, you can't leave it. With our Lord, it's all or nothing.
In economics, there is a law that bad money drives out good money.
Yeah.
Is that an example?
It's an example of the same thing, yes. That one bad belief, if it's allowed to, will eat up all the good beliefs. If it's allowed to stay in contact with the good beliefs, and the bad belief will almost certainly go in the direction of original sin. So the bad belief combined with original sin will eat up the good beliefs, unless the good beliefs drive out the bad belief.
Has that happened in church history, that the good beliefs have succeeded in driving out the bad beliefs?
Well, the Counter-Reformation, the reaction of the Catholic Church to Protestantism, the Catholic Church made a tremendous a statement of faith in the decrees and dogmas of the Council of Trent. And a lot of the Protestant errors were driven out of the Church, yes. Of course, they remain amongst the Protestants, but the Catholic Church really pulled itself together, so to speak, in the face of the enemy, and became much stronger.
So it may be, then, that traditional Catholics just have to stick to their guns, and in the end, they'll win out.
I don't think there's any doubt about it. And even if all of us were martyred, we would still win out by going to heaven. But I don't think it's going to come to all of us being martyred. The traditional faith will still be there when Vatican II is buried.
But do you think for that to happen, the churchmen or mankind will have to fall flat on its face first?
I think it's going to take a chastisement, yes. I think it's going to take a chastisement to destroy, to wipe out the corrupted church and the corrupted world, to wipe out the corruption. And then, unfortunately, the corruption is going to come back, and then when it comes back, that will be the approach of the Antichrist. But all of that is in the future.
I'd like to look at the ideas of the Antichrist, and even if we're not headed towards in this era, the era of the Antichrist, in these times, the era of the Antichrist, certainly don't you think there are precursors of the Antichrist?
I've said, you know, and said on these tapes, I've said that I think, I may be wrong, but I think that what we're living through today is the dress rehearsal of the Antichrist, the fifth age of the church. Then it will finish in chastisement. Then will come a great, tremendous triumph of the church, the return in triumph of Catholic tradition, which will be the other side of the chastisement. And then the corruption of that triumph of the Catholic Church will be the most terrible corruption of all, the corruption of the Antichrist. And then comes the end of the world.
Is it part of the Antichrist's ideas to combine religions?
Oh, yes. Yes, indifferentism plays a great part in destroying the truth, because it mushes people's minds, it destroys their sense of truth, and allows them to follow anything and anybody. And then the Antichrist will present himself as the Savior. And he will be again religious, but he will be obviously completely against the true God.
So in other words, this indifferentism really is then just a stage.
Liberalism, indifferentism, atheism, the Antichrist. Because after atheism, people can't live without religion. And when religion is totally destroyed and discredited, then the Antichrist will present himself as a religious figure.
So all of this is really leading to a false religion in the end.
It's going to come back to religion, and it's going to be one false religion united under Satan, yes. That's Satan's idea.
Now, I would like to move on to a relatively new subject, and we have discussed the errors of religion in the modern world. One giant reality that Catholics have to face, and this is, I think, for Catholic families, a great agony, is the fact that the world around us seems to be becoming more and more corrupted. Now, has this corruption partly been caused by the spread of religious error?
Very much so. Error in the mind and immorality in the will, or immorality in behavior, go very much together. If you read the epistles of St. Paul, he is constantly connecting the two, because what's in the mind leads to what I think leads to how I act. If I believe in the fires of hell, and if I believe that breaking God's commandments is going to put me in the fires of hell, then I shall be strongly inclined not to break God's commandments in my behavior. But if, on the other hand, in my beliefs, I don't believe in the fires of hell, then I shall be much more loose in my behavior. So belief governs behavior. So a lack of belief means a lack of good behavior. And the loss of the faith is going to generate a universal immorality, such as we see all around us, yes.
But, let's say 100 years ago, you had already a great loss of faith. Protestantism was strong in Northern Europe and in the New World, and you also had many people who didn't really have a strong religion of any kind, yet you didn't have this great immorality that you have today.
Yes, but the immorality was on its way. If you read the encyclical of 1832 of Gregory the 16th, which is Mirari Vos, you can read the Pope. The Pope is screaming. Popes don't scream, and they don't yell, and they don't scream. They do it in a very decorous way. But decorously, very correctly, and in a very dignified way, Gregory the 16th is punching the fire alarm, and he's punching it off the wall. He's ringing the alarm off the wall, because he sees just how perverse the liberal ideas are that are coming in. He sees how much they threaten the world, and he quotes from the Old Testament prophets, quotes about immorality being let loose. And it's as though the Pope was already seeing, the Pope Gregory the 16th in 1832, it's as though he's already seeing the pornography and the abortion and the internet, and the, it's as though he's got it already, nearly 200 years ago, already under his eyes, because he understands what is going to be the consequence in people's behavior of this complete dissolution of the truth in their minds. He can see that minds are going to be mushed, that the truth is going to be completely dissolved, and if truth in the mind is dissolved, then right and wrong in behavior are necessarily dissolved.
So in other words, he foresaw that this liberalism, being free from God's law and leaving the faith, would eventually lead in time to a dissolution of morality.
Yeah, yes, he saw it. And other popes through the 19th century saw exactly the same thing. And they, Pope Pius, you mentioned 100 years ago that religion, compared with today, religion was still fairly strong inside the church and even outside, let's say 1905. But that 1905, 100 years ago, was under the reign of Pope Pius X. And Pope Pius X was also punching the fire alarms off the wall. He was a warning of the great immorality to come. And he, you may remember, I think in his first encyclical, he wondered whether the Antichrist was not already born. Of course, we now know that it's definitely not. But the situation was such, for his clear sight, like Gregory the 16th, he could see through the appearances to the reality. And he saw that the reality was already, 1905, extremely grave. And yet we today, looking back, 1905 looks like a picnic in all kinds of ways compared with what we've got going on today.
So to a certain extent, what we have to be careful of is lowering our standards, that we think that 1905 society was actually quite good, but even at that time, it had fallen a long way from, let's say, the High Middle Ages, when probably society was its closest to God.
Yes. The High Middle, as you say, the High Middle Ages were a high point of Christendom. And then the states and the structures favored the salvation of souls, which was a great help. Whereas today, the structures and the states are largely atheistic or indifferent. That is a huge difference. But the immorality goes a ways back.
And it's really just burst out, let's say, in the last 30 or 40 years.
It's especially burst out since Vatican II, yes. Prior to Vatican II, if you look at photographs, I'm looking at a copy of Life from the 1950s, the ladies, they hardly appeared in the streets without hats and gloves. They were all in skirts. The dress was still dignified and feminine, womanly. The men also dressed in a dignified way. And then from the 1960s onwards, the dress just goes to pieces. And today, you've got men and women dressing like tramps and sluts. It's appalling.
Well, it's very interesting to see how, let's say, people's dress over the last generation has become sloppier and sloppier, and in some cases even worse, very immodest. Does that kind of mirror then what's happening within people's minds and hearts and souls?
Very much. The way in which people dress reflects who they are and what they are and what they believe in and what they think. I mean, if they had respect for their neighbors, they wouldn't dress in such a way as to tempt them. And if they realize that the temptation might lead souls to hell, to falling into hell, if they believed in hell, they wouldn't want to tempt souls in such a way as to help them to fall into hell. But
is this true also of the clergy? Because after Vatican II, nuns' habits came off, a lot of priests stopped wearing their priestly garb, and churchmen more and more looked less and less like churchmen.
Yes, the traditional dress of Catholic priests and Catholic nuns reflects their mortification. The color black is the color of death. Mortification means putting to death, fatuo and mors. So
it's dying to self.
Yes, dying to self in order to live to God, dying to sin in order to live to eternal life. It's a putting to death of the world, the flesh, and the devil. If you no longer believe that the world, the flesh, and the devil are that bad, well, then you will dress like everybody else.
Well, wasn't that part of the theme of Vatican II? In that Pope John the 23rd regarded Vatican II as the opening up of the Church to the world.
Yes. The modern popes believe, are deeply convinced, that the modern world is not as bad as the Catholics have been saying it is for so long, especially the Catholic popes. For instance, Pope Pius XII issued grave warnings about the modern world, but John the 23rd, in the opening discourse of the Council, of the Second Vatican Council, which was towards the end of 1962, Pope John the 23rd said, amongst other things, "Away with the prophets of doom. People are not bad, the modern world is not bad, we're not on the way to doomsday. Let's forget this negative attitude of the Church towards the modern world, and let's instead adopt a much more positive attitude, as they would say today, and let's open up the Church to the world in order that the Church can get through to the world and the world can be reached by the Church." That was his idea.
So there was some false optimism, then, was one of the features of Vatican II.
It's a feature of Vatican II, and it's a feature of all believers in the New World Order, because the New World Order, amongst other things, denies original sin. The New World Order appeals to men's sensuality and pride. If I'm proud, I don't like to think I'm a sinner. If I'm proud, I won't believe in original sin. I will believe that I'm a very good person. And it's part of the New World Order, then, to exalt the human person instead of recognizing that he has original sin and a constant tendency to do what's wrong. And with this exaltation of human nature and this exaltation of man and this depreciation of original sin, you create a new world.
Do you think that part of the problem since Vatican II in the Church and well also in society as a whole, is that there has been, let's say, what psychologists call a process of denial? That people say, well, things in the Church really aren't that bad. And they grasp at straws.
There's a tremendous amount of denial going on. The whole new Church, the whole new world order, the whole globalist idea is the denial of the reality of original sin, the reality of heaven and hell, the reality of the real God, the reality of Jesus Christ, the reality of the redemption, the reality of our need of the sacraments. All of this is denied, all of this is real, and all of it is denied in the new way of thinking and acting.
And I had also talked about grasping at straws. Let's say among conservatives, there is some kind of realization that the Church is in a bad way, but then they grasp at a straw, saying, well, the Pope came out with such and such a message, and that means that things are on the mend.
Well, the modern world is glamorous. It's glitzy and it's glamorous. And so it's easy to believe that it succeeds, it's achieved great material successes with its technology. It's easy to believe that it's not as bad as all that. And if you don't see clearly the deep down problems in the ideas of the new Church and the new world order, then you don't see the wrongness of the new religion and the danger of the tendency towards the new religion. And in that case, you see your Catholic obedience, quote unquote, kicks in. And you say, well, he is the Pope. So we've got to do what he says, and he's not gone way off the rails. See, such people, such conservatives, don't see how far these popes have the new popes have in their ideas gone wrong, and so they don't see the necessity of obeying God rather than man, and so they're looking for any excuse to go on obeying man and obeying the Pope. And therefore, they, as you say, grasp at straws, and they will take any suggests indication of anything that's still Catholic as an excuse to continue to obey and stay in the false, on the false path.
We have talked in our previous discussion about how there's a greater and greater tide of immorality in the modern world. And we also want to talk in this interview how traditional Catholics should cope with this, because that, I'm sure that presents a threat to our salvation. What are some of the manifestations of this tide of immorality, and what are some of the directions where it's heading now?
Well, there are the, I'd say there are the obvious directions, but they may not necessarily be the worst directions. For instance, the obvious direction is more and more immodesty in films and on television and in the newspapers, more and more nudity. The subtle direction is more and more mushing of the mind. I keep coming back to this because I think it's crucial. The more and more people are in confusion, more and more people are saying anything goes in any department. And I think that this mushing of the mind is more dangerous than, more deeply dangerous than the attack of sensuality, than the attack of impurity, because impurity is a particular domain, but the mind losing its grip on truth and losing its grip on reality is absolutely general.
So in other words, when people lose their grip on reality, when the mind becomes mushed, that leads to confusion in all areas.
Yes.
And what we see, what's getting a lot of our attention, is this increase in immorality then?
Well, what strikes most clearly and openly is the impurity against the sixth and ninth commandments.
And it causes the most deepest offense in one's gut reactions.
And then the violence, which is the fifth commandment, and then the lies, which are the eighth commandment, the media full of lies, and then the greed, seventh and tenth. So, you know, you're breaking the minor commandments. But I think that the mushing of the mind is against the first commandment, because if I lose my grip on reality, how can I not lose my grip on the real God? And if I lose my grip on the real God, I'm going to replace him with a whole lot of idols, especially technology. Technology plays the part of an idol. And I'm going to introduce into my life all of these electronics, and I'm going to feel good about having the latest machine, the latest doodad, and the latest gizmo, because that way I shall feel I'm advancing and progressing. And in fact, I am making technology into an idol, and that's what I really believe in and what I'm really worshipping as against the true God.
So in other words, sometimes what seems like progress, what seems like an advance, is actually the opposite, because it's pulling us away from God.
That's what surely is the case. It has been the case for many years. The devil has distracted Christendom and Christians with all of these, all of this quote-unquote science and material progress, and people are distracted by things material from things spiritual. The things material in themselves, just in themselves, taken by themselves, are not necessarily bad, but the way that Satan introduces them into the modern world and the way that a large number of people use these things, they serve Satan, and therefore they become bad in that way.
Now, I want to return to one of the points that you made, because it's so, so important. What you seem to be implying is that if one breaks the first commandment, very soon then one will start breaking all of the other commandments.
That's very true. We see it clear. There's a very, very clear example in the case of homosexuality. St. Paul, in the first chapter of the Epistle to the Romans, condemns homosexuality. He repeats three times that homosexuality follows idolatry. In other words, breaking the sixth commandment follows breaking the first. And the first commandment is the most important of all the Ten Commandments. And people think, as you were saying earlier, that they're not breaking the first commandment because they're not denying God and they're not deliberately and openly insulting him. But in fact, they are living with idols in their lives. A lot of people idolize their golf course, they idolize their motor car, they idolize their television set. But above all, and more deeply, they idolize a modern technological way of life upon which they depend for their salvation. So, and as you say, once you put a false god on the number one, in the number one spot in your life, immorality automatically follows. That's what St. Paul says, and that's what you just said.